All right, welcome back to the deep dive. Today we're going to be doing, one of our more law-focused deep dives. We're going to be looking at a specific case out of Arizona.
Okay.
So this is Maxwell v. Fidelity Financial Services, Inc. And this is a really fascinating case because it kind of gets to the heart of, how far the law will go to protect people from contracts that are just, on their face, completely unfair.
Right. Yeah.
So hopefully we'll be able to, take a little bit of a journey with this case, understand some of the legal principles that are involved, and also, just kind of get a sense for, how these things play out in real life. So, where do we even start with a case like this?
Well, I think a good place to start is always with the facts.
Right.
What actually happened.
Yeah. Who are the players? What went down? That kind of thing.
Exactly. So in this case, we have Elizabeth Maxwell, who was a hotel maid back in 1984. And she was, just trying to make ends meet.
Right.
She wasn't making a lot of money. And she decided to finance a solar water heater.
Okay. That seems, like a reasonable thing, especially back then, right? I mean, solar was kind of the future.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, a hot new technology. And, she's trying to save money, be more energy efficient, all the right reasons.
Huh.
So the water heater itself cost $6,512.
Okay.
Which, in 1984, that's, that's a chunk of change.
Yeah.
But here's where things start to get a little bit tricky.
Okay.
The interest rate on this financing agreement was 19.5%.
Oh, wow. That is high.
Yeah, that is extremely high. And so over the 10-year period of this loan, she ended up having to pay about $15,000 for this $6,500 water heater.
Okay. So even if the water heater worked perfectly,
right,
that's, more than double the price.
Exactly.
And I'm guessing it did not work perfectly.
It did not.
Okay. Tell me about that.
And in fact, it never worked.
Oh, wow.
And it was eventually condemned by the city.
Okay. So she's paying like twice the price for this thing and it never even worked.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's tough.
It is a very tough situation to be in. And, despite the fact that this water heater was completely useless.
Right.
She still made payments for 3.5 years.
Wow. So I guess she was probably thinking, I'm locked into this contract.
Right.
There's nothing I can do. I just got to keep making these payments.
Exactly. But then in 1988, she needed an additional $800.
Okay.
And instead of just giving her a separate loan for $800,
okay,
Fidelity decided to kind of roll everything together.
Oh, so they combined.
They combined the old loan with the new loan. They added in some insurance charges, and they came up with this brand new loan for about $17,000.
Okay.
And again, at that same high, 19.5% interest rate.
So it's like they're, they're taking advantage of her situation.
Right. It certainly seems that way. And to make matters even worse, these loans weren't just secured by this broken water heater.
Oh, okay. They were also secured by a lien on her house.
Oh, wow.
Which at the time was valued at about $40,000.
So she's potentially putting her home at risk for this water heater that never worked.
Exactly.
Wow. That's really rough.
It is. And so finally in 1990, she decided to sue Fidelity.
Okay. Good for her.
And she argued that the original 1984 contract was unconscionable.
So unconscionable meaning like just so unfair that it shouldn't be enforced.
Exactly. And the term unconscionable has a very specific meaning in the law.
Right. I was just going to say, is that like a legal term?
It is a legal term.
Okay.
And it basically means that the contract is so one-sided, so unfair, that it shocks the conscience of the court.
Okay. All right. So like it's so bad that the court is basically like, we can't let this stand.
Exactly. But initially, she faced a setback in the lower courts.
Really? Why is that?
Well, the lower courts sided with Fidelity, and they agreed with Fidelity's argument that the 1988 loan had created what's called a novation.
Okay. I'm not familiar with that term. What is a novation?
So a novation is basically when you substitute a new contract for an old contract.
Okay.
And so Fidelity's argument was that this 1988 loan agreement essentially replaced the 1984 contract.
Okay.
And therefore, Maxwell couldn't go back
and
challenge the terms of that original agreement.
So they're basically saying, like, we made a new deal.
Right.
And the old deal is just, wiped clean.
Exactly. But thankfully, the Arizona Supreme Court stepped in.
Right.
And they reversed those lower court decisions.
Okay, good. I was going to say, because otherwise it seems like, a pretty raw deal for Elizabeth Maxwell.
Absolutely. And the Supreme Court had a couple of key questions that they were trying to address in this case.
Okay.
First of all, does this doctrine of novation actually prevent a claim of unconscionability?
Right.
And second, should courts even consider whether a novation has occurred before they determine if the original contract was unconscionable?
Right. So, like, does it even matter that there was a novation if the original contract was, you know, completely out of bounds?
Exactly. And the Supreme Court went into a lot of detail about this concept of unconscionability.
Okay.
And they talked about two different types of unconscionability.
Okay.
You have procedural unconscionability.
Okay.
And you have substantive unconscionability.
Okay. I think you had mentioned that earlier. Could you kind of break those down for me? Like, what's the difference between those two?
Sure. So procedural unconscionability has to do with the process by which the contract was formed.
Okay.
So you're looking at things like, you know, was there unequal bargaining power between the parties?
Right.
Were there any hidden terms or deceptive practices?
Okay.
Did one party have like a much greater understanding of the terms than the
right.
other party?
Yeah.
So it's really about fairness in the bargaining process.
Right.
And then substantive unconscionability focuses on the actual terms of the contract themselves. Mm. So are the terms so one-sided, so oppressive,
okay.
You know, so unfair
yeah.
that they basically shock the conscience of the court?
Gotcha.
And in Maxwell's case, the court identified a number of factors that they thought were substantively unconscionable.
Okay.
The biggest one being this price-cost disparity.
Right.
You know, she's paying $15,000 for something that probably cost Fidelity, you know, a fraction of that.
Right.
And that never even worked.
It never even worked.
Right. They also pointed to the very high interest rate.
Right.
And the fact that her home was being used as collateral.
Right.
So, you know, all of those things together really painted a picture of a contract that was just deeply unfair.
Yeah.
And the Arizona Supreme Court actually made a really important point here.
Okay.
They said that substantive unconscionability alone
okay.
can be enough to make a contract unenforceable.
Okay. So they're basically saying even if the process by which the contract was formed was
right.
totally fine,
right.
if the terms themselves are so bad,
then the contract can be thrown out.
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, this is really important because it means that courts are willing to step in
right.
and protect people from contracts.
Right.
Even if those contracts were technically entered into
yeah.
freely and voluntarily.
Okay. Interesting.
If the terms themselves are so bad, the court can say, no, this is not enforceable.
Wow. Okay. So I guess that's what happened with Elizabeth Maxwell, right?
Yeah. So going back to the novation issue.
Right.
The Supreme Court said that for a novation to be valid,
okay.
there has to be a valid contract in the first place
right.
that's being replaced.
Okay.
And since they found that the original 1984 contract was unconscionable,
right.
they said that the 1988 agreement couldn't be a novation
right.
because it was essentially trying to replace something
right.
that was never valid to begin with.
Okay. So it's like you were saying earlier, you can't build a new house on a cracked foundation.
Exactly. And so the Supreme Court sent the case back down
to the lower courts
right.
to determine whether the original 1984 contract was in fact unconscionable.
Okay.
But one of the justices, Justice Martone,
okay.
he actually wrote a separate opinion.
Okay.
Where he said that he thought the unconscionability was so clear
okay.
that the court should have just ruled in Maxwell's favor right then and there.
Wow. Okay. So he was like, there's no need to even send it back down. It's just so obvious.
Exactly.
Wow. Okay. So what does all this mean for, like, you know, the average person? Why should people care about this case?
Well, I think this case is important for a couple of reasons.
Okay.
First of all, it really highlights this idea that courts are willing to step in and
yeah.
protect people from contracts that are just fundamentally unfair.
Right.
And it's not just about protecting people from, you know, like, being tricked or deceived.
Right.
It's also about protecting people from contracts that are just so one-sided,
yeah.
so oppressive,
right.
that they just shock the conscience. And I think that's a really important principle.
Yeah, definitely.
And the second thing I think this case highlights is that even if you enter into a new agreement
okay.
that's related to a previous agreement,
okay.
if that original agreement was unconscionable,
right.
those issues can still be challenged in court.
Okay.
So you can't just, you know, paper over a bad contract
right.
with a new contract.
Okay.
If the foundation is rotten,
right.
the house is going to fall down.
Yeah. Makes sense.
And I think there was actually a really good quote from one of the analyses of this case
Oh,
that I
yeah.
thought kind of summed it up nicely.
Okay.
They said, if the debt created by the 1984 contract was unconscionable when entered into,
okay,
then it was unenforceable.
Okay.
Therefore, Maxwell had no obligation, and there was nothing to novate or substitute for.
Right.
So it's like, if the original debt was never valid,
right,
then you can't really create a new debt,
right,
to replace it.
Right.
It's just not a thing.
It's just not a thing, yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess the big question then is, like, how does this apply to, you know, the modern world?
Right.
Like, we're not in 1984 anymore.
Oh, you're not.
You know, contracts are more complicated now.
Right.
You know, there's all sorts of new technology and, you know, new ways of doing business.
Right.
So how does this concept of unconscionability really play out in today's world?
That's a great question. And I think it's something that courts are still grappling with.
Right.
How do you apply these principles of fairness to these increasingly complex contracts
that
people are entering into?
Yeah.
You know, you have things like, you know, online terms of service agreements that nobody reads.
Right.
But that can be incredibly one-sided.
Right.
You have, you know, these very sophisticated financial instruments.
Yeah.
That, you know, even experts sometimes have trouble understanding.
Right.
So I think it's an ongoing challenge for the courts to figure out how to apply this concept of unconscionability in a way that's fair and that protects consumers.
Yeah.
But I think Maxwell v. Fidelity is a really good example of how courts are willing to step in and say, no, this is too far.
Right.
This is not okay.
It's just not right.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, this has been a really fascinating deep dive.
Yeah.
You know, I think we've learned a lot about, you know, this really important legal concept of unconscionability.
I think so, too.
And, you know, I hope our listeners have, too.
Me, too.
So thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely.